Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Nick Wagner, and he's going to talk about OPA. It's a fish that was recently discovered to be warm-blooded, or to be more nearly corrected, endothermic. Nick is a research fisheries biologist working for NOAA Fisheries at the Southwest Fisheries Center in La Jolla, California. He's also a lecturer at the Scripps Center, Scripps Institution of Oceanography. That's where he earned his PhD in marine biology. He grew up in Connecticut and in Chicago, got his BS from the University of California, San Diego. His parents and grandparents lived out here in Southern California, so he used to come out every summer, and that's when he fell in love with the ocean and with tide pools. His research ranges from understanding the physiological specializations of fast swimming fishes to working with the recreational fishing community to assess the effects of bycatch, or rather of catch and release fishing on these populations. I heard Nick give this talk and was so impressed, I wanted him to come here so you could all hear it. Please join me in welcoming Nick Wagner.
Thank you for having me up here tonight. I'm really excited to tell you a little bit about a really fun and exciting discovery that we made about the OPA and it being warm-blooded. Just to start off, I wanted to read this quote. This is from the Washington Post. This was a story that came out right after we made this this fun finding. And it says, "It's one of the most basic biology facts we're taught in school growing up. Birds and mammals are warm-blooded, while reptiles, amphibians, and fish are cold-blooded. But new research is turning this well-known knowledge on its head with the discovery of the world's first warm-blooded fish, the OPA." And so what I'd like to talk about tonight are a few things. I'll start out by just talking about what is an OPA. This is a fish that most people aren't familiar with. It's a fish that I knew nothing about, really, when we started this project. We'll also talk about warm-blooded versus cold-blooded. So you notice in the title of my talk, I had warm-blooded in quotation marks. And so we'll talk about a little bit what these terms mean. And then I'm going to talk about what are called regionally endothermic fish. And these kind of fall somewhere in between warm-blooded and cold-blooded. And then I'm going to talk about the OPA, which is a fish that exhibits what we call whole-body endothermy. It's able to warm up its entire body, which is unique outside the mammal and bird world. So just to kind of get started, let's see if this clicker will work. There we go. Okay, so here's the OPA, or the moonfish. It's got a worldwide distribution in tropical and temperate waters. And what's really interesting is, for whatever reason, and we have no idea why, these fish started showing up off our coast in fairly high numbers over the last few years. We're not sure why this is, but it provided the opportunity to start studying them. And this is a fish that's been poorly studied, and we were obviously able to make some kind of interesting discoveries. This fish is found anywhere from the surface down to about 500 meters. We usually refer to it as a mesopelagic fish, or a fish that lives kind of in the twilight zone. So there's not a lot of light. It's dark, and it's relatively cold. This is a large predatory fish, just to give you an idea of how big this fish is. That's it. So yeah, a lot of people, when I show them a picture of an OPA, like, oh, it's this cute little red fish. And it's a really big, cute little red fish. And this guy that's in this picture is not a little guy either. So this is a fish. This fish was caught actually last year off just a couple hundred miles south of here, and is actually the world record for individual angler. So they're both commercially important and recreationally important, and the main reason for this is that they actually taste very good. Most of what we know about them is in relation to this. So they are commercially targeted. You'll find them in restaurants like in Hawaii, and you can find them here occasionally as well in the restaurants. The most important fact in what we're going to be talking about in this today is that these are warm-blooded. Again, I have in quotations warm-blooded. But the title of our article where we presented this new research was whole body endothermy in a mesopelagic fish. And so what I'd like to talk about is this term warm-blooded and then in the term endothermy. So if you think about, the question becomes, what does it mean to be warm-blooded? And you can ask lots of different people what it means, and you'll get different answers. Warm-blooded is actually kind of more of a layman's term. It's not really used very much in the scientific community. And the reason it is not used that much is because there's lots of definitions for it. And actually, if you go into the dictionary, you'll find different things. Some say it means the blood is warm. Some say it means an animal can keep its temperature constant and different things. But let's just kind of go with our, I think everybody in here knows exactly what it means, or do we? So here's a warm-blooded animal. We usually think of warm-blooded animals as cute little fuzzballs like this. This is the European hamster. And just kind of as an experiment here, let's say this animal is sitting in a room at room temperature, so about 68 degrees Fahrenheit, 20 degrees Celsius. And we know that the body temperature of this animal will be something like 99 degrees Fahrenheit, right? Something very similar to us. Okay, so then we take our classic cold-blooded animal. Here's a lizard just waking up in the morning in the desert. The air temperature is similar, let's say 68 degrees, just like where the hamster is. And the body temperature of this animal is 68 degrees as well. Okay, well, let's change the scenario around a little bit. Let's erase that. And let's say that it's now the desert. It warms up during the day. And now the air temperature becomes 100 degrees Fahrenheit. The sand gets even hotter, so the sand's 120. And now the animal is probably somewhere in between the sand. He's touching the sand, he's touching the air. His body temperature is maybe now about 108 degrees. Is it really cold anymore? Not really. And so you can kind of see why I've put these terms in quotations. And then we take this hamster, let's erase that. Let's say it's winter time, the air temperature is 37 degrees Fahrenheit, something like 3 degrees Celsius. That makes this animal want to hibernate. So he turns into this nice little ball here. But it's not a very warm ball. He looks very cuddly, but he's not. He's very cold. His body temperature is something like 43 degrees Fahrenheit. And so here you can see where those terms kind of start to break down, warm-blooded versus cold-blooded. And so what we use instead are these terms called ectothermy and endothermy. And what you can see in this example is that this animal, even though its body temperature is not very warm, it's warmer than the environment, whereas this guy, even though its body temperature is very warm, it's about the same as the environment. And so we talk about these terms ectothermy. Ecto means outside, and thermy means is related to temperature. And so this means that these animals, ectotherms, derive their body heat from the outside environment. Whereas, well, I didn't mean to do that. Let's see. I think I'm getting some help from upstairs. Okay, so if we talk about endothermy, this is where body heat is derived from inside the animal itself. So this animal is carrying out different metabolic processes that warm up its body. Okay, and so we can go back to our kind of our classic examples. So an endotherm is kind of this warm-blooded animal. An ectotherm is cold-blooded. And if we kind of go to our traditional kind of ideas of what it means to be warm-blooded or cold-blooded, we start grouping animals on either side of this divisive line here. So we have our cuddly mammals and birds. Here's some marine mammals and birds. And then we have our ectotherms. So we have things like reptiles, fish, amphibians, and different invertebrates. And what we see is that these two different thermal strategies have different advantages and disadvantages. So an endothermic animal has the advantages that it can kind of maintain a more optimal temperature. Whatever temperature it wants to be most optimal, it can try to produce that temperature. They're also less subject to the environment around them. So they're not affected. If it gets a little bit colder in here, I'm just as effective in my metabolic processes. I can run just as fast if it chilled down 10 degrees in the room. The disadvantage is that it's energetically expensive. So it takes a lot of energy to warm up one's body. And then if we look at ectotherms, it's basically the opposite. So the advantage is that it's energetically cheap, but the disadvantage is that you're now subject to your environmental temperatures. And you can't maintain the optimal temperature that you'd necessarily like to be at. And so this sea snake right here, this is a picture of a sea snake that washed up on shore in San Diego. And it washed up on shore because it came up with the warm water this summer during the El Nino event. And when the waters cooled down, it was no longer in its optimal temperature. And it ultimately couldn't survive in that temperature. And it stranded on the beach. One of the kind of classic examples I like to give, and this is an experiment you can do at home. You can take your kids or your grandkids and do this experiment with them, is to take a classic endotherm or ectotherm, and we'll say a beetle, for example. And you can go into your backyard and catch a beetle and stick them in a Tupperware and chase them around with your hand. And that beetle will run around and try to avoid your finger. You take that beetle and stick them into the refrigerator and come back half an hour later. You might want to put a lid on, right, so he doesn't get out. And you come back half an hour later, an hour later, take that beetle back out, and you try to chase him around with your finger, and that beetle will barely move. And the reason is because that animal is ectothermic, it's dependent on its environment, it cools down with the temperature, and all of the reactions within its body are slowed way down. And so it can't contract its muscles nearly as fast. It can't respond to stimuli nearly as fast. Everything moves slower at colder temperatures. And so you can kind of see the disadvantage in this example of being ectothermic. Okay, so let's talk about, I'm not going to show very many graphs, but this is the one I'm going to show. This was a kind of a cool study that was came out last year in Science Magazine. And they kind of quantified different aspects of this relationship between performance. So here's a physiological advantage with, in this example, growth rate. So if you're higher on this graph, you have higher growth rates. And then here's your metabolic rate or kind of your energy costs. And so what they did is they started taking all these different groups of animals and plotting them on this graph. And so they had things like placental mammals, okay, so here are kind of classic endothermic or warm-blooded animals. They put on their marsupials, another kind of mammal. They put on a couple different groups of birds. Having a few problems with this clicker here. Some different groups of birds, and then they started putting on to this graph these kind of more typical ectothermic animals. So here you have crocodilians and turtles. You've got lizards and snakes, we've got sharks, and we've got different kinds of bony fishes. And what you can see is that really nicely, kind of back to kind of our grade school definition of warm-blooded versus cold-blooded, these animals group together. Okay, so you have these endotherms with higher growth rates and using more energy, and then over here you have ectotherms using less energy but also growing slower. And this seems like a pretty straightforward story until you start adding a few other animals in here that are kind of these weird ball animals. So we have things like an echidna. This is a mammal found in Australia. One of these guys that lays eggs, really weird animal. And you can see it's kind of grouping over here with these guys. And then you can add some other animals. Okay, here's tunas. Here's the Mako shark, and here's the leatherback sea turtle. And you can see that they don't really group with the groups that we think they should. And what you can actually do is you can take this data, and there's your ectotherms and your endotherms, and then we have these animals kind of in between, which we call temporal endotherms or regional endotherms. So temporal means they warm up their bodies sometimes. Okay, there's a lot of insects that fall into this category. Insects can warm up their bodies sometimes when they're flying, for example. And then we have regional endotherms. These are animals that can warm up parts of their bodies. So things like tunas and Mako sharks can warm up certain parts of the body. And so you can kind of see our definition of warm-blooded and cold-blooded kind of starting to break down. And what you can do is you can take this data and draw a line through it, kind of a line of best fit. And so what I'd argue is there's really kind of a progression where we have down on this end very, okay, ectothermic animals. Up here we have endothermic animals, but in between we have something else. And so we can go back to kind of this divisive chart here, and we really see that these groups don't necessarily adhere to these two different sides, and really there probably shouldn't be two different sides at all, but rather there's this kind of continuum where you have animals that are, again, completely ectothermic, some that are endothermic, and some that fall somewhere in between. And these ones that fall in between, again, are regional endotherms or temporal endotherms. And what I'm going to talk about the rest of the talk, just to kind of go back to my outline and remind you, is, okay, we talked about the warm-blooded versus cold-blooded. Now we're going to talk about some regional endothermic fishes. And then we're going to get into the OPA, which is what I'm most excited to tell you about. Okay, so regional endothermy is kind of defined in this way: internal production of heat allowing for certain organs or certain parts of the body to be warmed. There are 30,000 fish species out there. Of those 30,000 fish species, there's a small fraction of them that are able to do what we call regional endothermy. There's about 20 species that are able to warm up what's called the red aerobic swimming musculature. This is the muscle that's used for continuous swimming. So if you eat a piece of fish, there's the white meat, which is the very tasty stuff, and then there's that kind of like dark meat real close to the skin, and that's the aerobic musculature. That's what's used to power continuous swimming. And so the animals that fall into this group are the tunas, the lamned sharks. In one of the first paper that I published, this was with a bunch of other authors looking at the common thresher shark falls into this group as well. And these are just able to warm up just parts of these swimming muscles. And they're able to spread some of this heat to other parts of the body, including the viscera, which is the digestive organs, and in some cases, the eye and brain. And then there's about 12 other species that can warm up the cranial region. And this is done through contraction of the eye muscles. And this includes things like the billfishes and the butterfly mackerel. And there was a study that came out in 2009 that suggested that the OPA might be able to do this as well. And what I'm going to show you tonight is that the OPA can actually do a lot more than just warming up the eye and brain. And you might say, well, why is it advantageous to warm up any of these sections of the body? And let's go back to kind of that beetle experiment. So if you have warmer muscles, you can swim faster, your muscles contract faster, they produce more power. If you have a warm eye and brain, you can process images faster, so you have increased visual resolution. You can respond faster to stimuli in your environment. So both of these things are very advantageous. And so how does this work? So let me show you a couple pictures. These are cross sections through the muscle of a couple different animals. So this is an ectothermic shark. Here's the backbone right here. This is the muscle, this is all the meat, and then this is the digestive organs here. And you can see this dark muscle right here along the edge of the body. This is called the red or aerobic musculature. And this is what's used in continuous swimming. Okay, so it's red because it has lots of mitochondria, lots of blood vessels, and it's used to power these animals swimming all the time. In a regionally endothermic shark, you can see that this red muscle is no longer located on the outside of the body. And by the way, 99% of fishes fall in this category here. But these very few oddball species, they have seen their red muscle migrate towards the center of the body, and now it's insulated from the external environment. And so having red muscle in this location shields it partially from the water, and so they can warm up this kind of core region, and through specialized blood vessels, they might be able to warm up the viscera, which is very close. But the rest of the body up here is all going to be cold still. And so this looks something like this. So here is a lamned shark, and you can see here in the center of the body, it's quite warm, and then on the outsides in other areas, it's not. But if you take a cross-section through 99.9% of all other fish, you can see that they don't warm up any of the body whatsoever. And so you can think about this fish with a warm body with faster contracting muscles chasing around a fish with cold muscles, and it becomes not much of a fight. So in order to have what we call regional endothermy, you have to have a few things. You have to have a heat source, okay? And this is, in this case, a constantly contracting muscle. So this is the muscle that these guys use in swimming. These shark species, laminated sharks, tunas, they never stop swimming. So that muscle is constantly contracting. If you're talking about a cranial endotherm, so a swordfish or a marlin, they can warm up. Their eye muscles are always moving. They're always looking around, and they can harness that heat. So that's the first requirement. The second requirement is that that heat source must be insulated from the environment to minimize convective heat loss. And so I showed that that muscle is located kind of near the backbone towards the center of the body. And the third requirement is these animals have to have what are called countercurrent heat exchangers. And these minimize heat loss at the gills. And so basically what these are specialized blood vessels. And what's so difficult for fish, the reason it's so difficult for fish to conserve body heat, and so few do it, is because, one, water has a very high heat capacity. And that means it's able to absorb a lot of heat. So just think of all of us in this room here. It's a brisk 68 degrees. Most of us are pretty comfortable in here. But now if you went out into the ocean or a swimming pool and it was 68 degrees, it would be rather cold. You wouldn't be able to stay in the water for very long before you started shivering. And the reason behind this is that water is really good at absorbing heat, and it just sucks the heat away from you. So for a fish that wants to warm up its body, it's got to put its muscles that's producing heat near the core of the body, but it's also circulating blood through the body. And this blood has to go to the gills to pick up oxygen. That's where they breathe water. And so when it goes to the gills, it's going to cool down. It's very close proximity to the water. And so what these animals have are what are called countercurrent heat exchangers. And these countercurrent heat exchangers are essentially blood vessels going one direction, carrying warm blood, heat up blood coming back from the gills, and transfer all of the heat before the blood arrives at the gills. And so the blood, warm blood, never comes in contact with the gills. And so I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Waterworld. It's an oldie and not a goodie. In that movie, Kevin Costner has gills. And he can breathe underwater. And there's lots of problems with that idea. It's really hard to fit gills behind your ears. But one of the other problems is that would never work because he doesn't have countercurrent heat exchangers. So as soon as his blood came in contact with the water, it would cool down. He would go into hypothermia in a matter of a couple minutes. Okay, so now the rumor is that when they were making Waterworld, they called my major professor. So my major professor, when I was in grad school, did a lot of research in regionally endothermic fish. And they called him and asked him about this idea, and he apparently set them straight, but they decided to produce the movie anyways. I don't know if that story is really true, but he claims it was. And he went over to Kevin Costner's house and everything. It was very elaborate. Okay, so here are three requirements for a fish to warm up parts of its body. Okay, and so here's another example. Here's a tuna. Here's that red aerobic muscle that's used in continuous swimming. So that's your heat source, that first requirement. That heat source is insulated from its surroundings. Okay, so it's near the middle of the body. And they have these countercurrent heat exchangers. And so if you actually take a little section right here and blow that up, you'll see these really cool blood vessels. So you have these big blood vessels here, which are the veins, and these have warm blood in them. And they're carrying the blood back to the heart and then ultimately to the gills. And then you have these arteries that are carrying cold blood coming from the gills. And these veins transfer all of their heat to these arteries going back into the muscle. And so right here, this part of the body of the tuna is warm, and the rest of it is pretty much the same temperature as the environment. Okay, so let's now talk about the OPA. This is a study. There's very few studies out there on OPA. This is a study from 1976, so 40 years ago, where these were researchers actually at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, where I did my grad work. And what they did is they caught an OPA, or I think a fisherman caught one. It was a very rare catch. They donated it to the lab. And these guys cut it open and started dissecting it and looking at it. And they saw that it has this very, very, very large red muscle mass, much larger than any other fish, really. And this really, really red muscle mass means that it uses this muscle for continuous swimming. And they thought, hey, maybe this muscle could be producing some heat. So that pectoral muscle, 37% of all of the propulsive muscle in the fish, which is really, really high. And what they also saw is that it was covered by a really thick layer of adipose tissue. And so if you zoom in on this, here you can see this very thick layer of fat that's covering this muscle. And you can actually pull that fat off, and that's what it looks like, this very, very thick layer. Fish don't have this. This is not something that's common in fish at all. And this looks actually more like a kind of a marine mammal, this layer of fat right underneath the skin. What they were kind of interested in is, hey, maybe this fish is able to warm up part of its body. So they were kind of really excited about this idea, but there were no elevated temperature measurements taken for this fish. So if you stuck a thermometer in it, it didn't seem like it was warm at all. They were missing this really big component. There was no signs whatsoever of a countercurrent heat exchanger. 40 years later, they ended this by saying, it is hoped that this paper may stimulate such observations. And so now, 40 years later, we're actually starting to get those sorts of observations, maybe finding these sorts of things. Now, what's really interesting about this is I had no idea about this paper when we started studying the OPA. And what's really ironic about this is this guy right here, Richard Rosenblatt, he was on my graduate committee. He never mentioned this study to me. This guy right here, Dave Johnson, he's a collaborator of mine. Neither of them had ever mentioned this study to me before. And why should they? Because we hardly ever see this fish. And then all of a sudden, 5 years ago, we started catching these fish. And just as kind of a little background, I did my PhD looking at the respiratory adaptations, looking at the gills of things like makos and tunas, these really fast-swimming fish, to see how they could absorb oxygen out of the water. And over the years, I kind of gained a reputation of being this guy that was obsessed with fish gills. In reality, I like to say I'm an expert on fish gills, but you can say what you want. One of my friends that knew I had this weird obsession with fish gills said, hey, we're catching OPA. Would you like some fish gills would you like some OPA gills? And I said, I felt like I had to say yes. But I wasn't really that interested. You know, I didn't really know much about the OPA. I didn't know about this study. There wasn't anything that interesting. You know, it's kind of this midwater fish that, you know, probably just kind of doesn't do that much. And so, but I said yes, because, you know, you kind of have, when somebody offers you fish gills, you have to say yes, right? And so I said yes. And so he went out and they were catching them on this survey, and so he collected some samples of the fish gills, and he put them into I gave him a bucket, and a bucket of preservative, and he put these into a bucket. And just so you know how obsessive I am about fish gills, I have like 50 of these buckets. And these are 5 gallon buckets that you can buy at like Home Depot. And you can see like here, I think that says Mako shark gills or something like that. Anyways, so he put them in this bucket, and they sat there for months. Because there wasn't really anything interesting that I thought was to be found by looking at these gills. And, you know, several months went by, and my friend asked me, hey, did you ever look at those gills? And I said, oh, no, I haven't. I'm about to do it. And so I went and did it. And so just to kind of give you an idea what an OPA gill looks like, that's it. This is the gill arch here. These are the gill filaments. This is where gas exchange occurs. And as soon as I cut into this gill, I noticed something that was different than any other gill that I had seen before, and a gill that anybody else had ever seen before. And that is this right here. And if we blow that up, this is just a bunch of small blood vessels inside this gill arch. Now, nobody's ever seen something like this before, or had at that time. And I had no idea what this was. I was like, there's a bunch of blood vessels in there. And so we were really curious of what these blood vessels were doing. And so what we did is, the next time he went out on this survey, I went with him. And we actually we couldn't tell where those blood vessels were going, what they were doing, and so we injected those blood vessels with what's called vascular casting solution. If you've ever been to the Bodies exhibit, it's essentially that. So you inject a resin, kind of like fiberglass resin that you would use to fix your surfboard, into the blood vessels of the animal, and it hardens, and it creates a perfect cast of the blood vessels. And since gills are just specialized blood vessels anyways, it turned out to be rather successful. And so here you can see kind of this, so these are the gills of the fish, and here you can see this blue coming up through here. That's that casting solution going into the gills. And what you can do is you can have a cast that looks like this, and you can turn it into a plastic cast that looks like this. And so if we take this, and we kind of blow it up. So here's the first gill arch of an OPA. And if we compare that to maybe a more typical bony fish, this isn't really a typical fish, but this is a tuna. You can see, so here are the gill filaments. This is where gas exchange plays. They both have these gill filaments for gas exchange. And then you can see in a typical fish, there's only a couple of blood vessels in here. There's an afferent artery, afferent branchial artery that brings blood into the gills, and an efferent branchial artery for bringing blood out of the gills. Now, for all of you that are taking notes, I can see it's very many people. Afferent, this is the way you remember. Afferent starts with an A. A is the first letter. So A going in, efferent, E, end, E going out, okay? And so you have one blood vessel bringing blood into the gill, one blood vessel coming out. But here, you can see there's a whole mess of stuff. And so if we zoom in, you see things like this. We zoom in over here, you see things like that. You can see these highly organized yet and contorting blood vessels. And we still had no idea, from looking at this, there's just so many blood vessels, I couldn't tell where all these curlicue blood vessels go. And so what we did is we went back to the fish, and we injected the fourth gill arch with two different colors of resin. So we injected the efferent vessels with red blood, so representing oxygenated blood. And we put blue in through the other side, the afferent side, the blood vessels going to the gills representing deoxygenated blood. And so if we take this gill arch, here we go. There it is. Okay, so here's your afferent vessels are in blue carrying blood into the gills, and then afferent vessels carrying blood out now that they've received oxygen. And what you can do is here's that afferent branchial artery bringing stuff in. Here's that afferent branchial artery bringing stuff out. And we can zoom in on an area like this. And this is what you see. This really cool alternating pattern of red, blue, red, blue, red, blue. Afferent, efferent, afferent, efferent. So you have all these blood vessels delivering blood to the gills, tightly coupled with blood vessels leaving the gills. And we can zoom in even further and take a little section like this. And this is an individual gill filament. And here you can see, here's this afferent vessel carrying deoxygenated blood to the respiratory exchange surfaces. It goes through the respiratory exchange surfaces. It comes back out red. And you see this red vessel coming back this way, right underneath the blue vessel. Okay. And so what we have are these afferent, this tight coupling of these afferent and efferent vessels. And what we thought when we saw this is, okay, so here is a mechanism where heat could be transferred before it arrives at the respiratory exchange surfaces. And where basically this vessel carrying deoxygenated blood, which is warm, transfers all of its heat to the blood vessel coming out of the gill. And so the heat never makes it to the gills where it would be lost. And so this is kind of what it looks like. If you take some cross sections through here, you can see all of these blood vessels here. Here's another section. And if you zoom in on a little box like this, you see something like this. So here's a blood vessel right next to another blood vessel right next to another blood vessel. And these right here are the red blood cells. They're just kind of pulled up as part of the preservation process. And then here alongside it, you can see all of this is fat. So all of that is insulated. Also something very weird for inside a gill arch. And so we said, okay, so here are requirements for endothermy. We have what we think could be a countercurrent heat exchanger. We put a nice big green check mark next to it. But what we really need to prove is, okay, does this really allow for heat conservation? Is there a heat source? And is that heat source insulated? And so we went back out into the field and to measure the internal temperatures of OPA. And so what we were able to do is take this ThermoWorks thermopen. So now this is for people that are really, really into cooking, okay? This is a really high-end thermometer. It has a 3-second response time, very necessary when if you're really into cooking. It has 0.1 degree resolution. It's water resistant, and of course it has a cool flame decal. Okay, so all of these things are very good for a good cooking thermometer, and it's also very good for taking the temperature of a fish. And so what we were able to do is bring fish up on board, and these fish were caught and sacrificed, and you could take the temperature of the fish at different locations, and we could come out with an idea of where these animals, or if these animals are warm. Now, one of the difficulties about working with an OPA is it's kind of this mesopelagic twilight zone fish. So it's found pretty deep in the ocean, and it's cold down there. And you're bringing this fish up to the surface where the water is quite warm. So it's kind of difficult to take a measurement of a fish in comparison to the habitat that it's in. And so what we did is we kind of searched around on the body of the fish to find kind of the coldest location. And we found that really close to the tail here. And so this is kind of our reference temperature. We're kind of supposing that this temperature is kind of the coldest area on the body of the fish, and we're supposing that that's close to the environmental temperature. And then we took temperatures other places. We took it in the pectoral muscles, so those really big muscles that are supporting the swimming of this animal. These fish swim, by the way, by using their pectoral fins, so very different than other fish. Most fish swim by using their tail. These fish swim by flapping their pectoral fins. And if you've ever seen a penguin swimming underwater, this is kind of what this fish looks like. It flaps these wings underwater, and that's where it generates most of its swimming movements. And so what we found is that the muscle in the pectoral region was about 4 degrees Celsius higher than this reference temperature. We also took temperature in the viscera or the stomach and digestive organs. That was about 3.5 degrees warmer. We found the heart temperature was about 3 degrees warmer. And then the eye and brain temperature was quite a bit warmer than that, about 6 degrees warmer. And so what you can do, and this is just 4 or 5 measurements that we took, but if you take, say, 35 or 40 measurements on all over the body of this animal, you can come up with a thermal profile. And so here you can see that this fish is pretty warm. Its eye and brain region is the warmest. And I remember I talked about in the very beginning, there was a study that suggested the OPA had a warm eye and brain. We definitely see that. What we also see is that much of the rest of the animal is warm as well. And remember, we're comparing to this reference temperature, so we don't know. This reference temperature could be somewhat warm as well. But that's the best we have in terms of fish that we can bring up onto the deck of the boat. And so we can put a nice big check mark right here. Okay, so there is a heat source, and probably multiple heat sources, one in the eye and brain, one in the pectoral region, and all real body processes produce heat. It's really about the conservation of that heat. So we see that these animals are able to warm up. And you could say, well, Nick, you know, you're bringing them up from a cold habitat. You're bringing them up to the surface. Maybe they're warming up on their way. And for whatever reason, the center of the body warms up faster than the outsides, which who knows. And so what we really needed to do is get temperature measurements of a fish swimming down at depth and measure those temperatures. And so what we did is we went back out. Oh, and here you can see, this is what an OPA looks like. Here he's swimming. You can see how he's moving those pectoral fins around. Kind of looks kind of goofy. But they are actually very, very strong, and just them flapping like that is really produces a lot of pull. So anyways, we caught some of these animals, and we created this really special stretcher. Looks something like that. And what we're able to do is bring these animals back up on board. And we were able to, so here's the stretcher here, the OPA stretcher, bring them up onto the deck of the boat. And what we were able to do is put a thermistor into the muscle. And so here's that thermistor right here. And then we have another thermistor on the outside of the body to measure water temperature. And in order to get the data back from this fish, we actually have to get this tag back. Okay. So what we would do is we would have this fish, it was caught on the fishing gear, we would put this thermistor in it, and then we would let it go still attached to the fishing gear. And so we would call this OPA on a ROPA. And so we took the OPA on a ROPA, and this worked really well, by the way. And so this is what we saw. So here is this fish. Here in this kind of light blue or whitish color here is the depth of the fish. In blue is the temperature of the water. And then here in red is the temperature of the fish inside the mussel. And so here you can see we let the fish go. It's swimming around. It dives down deep, down to, this isn't that deep actually, only about 60 meters. And here you can see the external temperature. The water drops down very low, but it maintains this temperature much higher than that of its surroundings. And then this is where we pulled the rope, the Opana ropa, back up to the surface. So here you can see he's at the surface. Here he's on the animal is sacrificed. Here he is, and then he's put into the freezer. And so the external temperature goes down. And you can see his internal temperature starts to go down as well. But again, he's insulated by this fat layer, so it goes down much more slowly. Okay, so then we can have this, we can put this final green check mark on here, that heat source is in fact insulated. This animal is warm when it's swimming down below the surface. And what's really interesting is you can compare that temperature that we got with this internal thermistor when the fish is swimming to what we got on the deck's fish, and it's actually slightly warmer. So here for a tagged fish, it's actually about 5 degrees instead of this 4 degrees here. And that's because this reference temperature is receiving warm blood. Warm blood is getting circulated through the whole body. So actually, it's warm here too. Not quite as warm, but it's warm there as well. And that's why this fish actually swimming around has a warmer temperature than what we observed here, because this is just in comparison to our reference temperature. Okay, so just to kind of summarize, we found endothermy in the OPA, and the majority of this heat appears to be produced by these pectoral muscles. We found an extensive retae mirabile, so this is another name for the countercurrent heat exchanger. Retae mirabile is Latin for wonderful net, and so it refers to these wonderful net of blood vessels where you have all these crisscrossing back and forth where this this heat is conserved, and it never allows this heat to be lost, or minimizes at least the heat lost at the gills. And what's different about the OPA than some of these other fish that I talked about, the tunas and the mako shark, is the unique location of this reet, of this countercurrent heat exchanger, that it's actually in the gills itself. And so that means that warm blood can basically isolates the gills from the rest of the body, and basically means that that warm blood can be circulated throughout the whole body. So that means the pectoral muscles are warm, the viscera is warm, the eye and brain is warm, and for the first time ever, we have a fish with a warm heart. And we kind of laugh about that. I think there was a Valentine that went out from an OPA about warm hearts that I saw on Twitter somewhere. But this is really important. There's no other fish that is able to warm up its heart. There's fish that are able to warm up some of their swimming muscles, they're able to warm up their eye and brain. But if you have a cold heart, you can't provide those warm muscles or that eye and brain with the oxygen that you necessarily need. And so if we compare what a tuna does to what an OPA does, you can kind of see why this is important. So this is a graph. Here you have a albacore tuna. These are found off our coast here. We have different depth bins of where they spend time. Okay, so this is the percent time here on the x-axis, and this is the depth here on the y-axis. And here I have a dotted line. This is called the bottom of the mixed layer. So basically, that's where the water is pretty warm. And once you get below the mixed layer, the water starts to get pretty cold. And you see that albacore tuna, they spend about, oh, say 60% of their time during the day above this mixed layer, or inside this mixed layer above this line. And then they dive down to depth to feed on fish that are down below this thermocline. And these animals that are, and so what they do is they basically do these bounce dives. They bounce down, their muscles stay warm, but their heart starts to cool down. And as soon as their heart cools down to a certain amount, they can no longer feed their warm muscles with the oxygen they need, and they have to come back to the surface to warm up their heart. So if we compare that to an OPA, you can see that an OPA spends a lot more time down at depth. And in fact, it spends very, very little time up here in this upper mixed layer where the water is warm. It spends almost all of its time down depth, especially during the day. At night, it comes up a little bit. And the reason it comes up at night is because a lot of these fish come up at night. And so what you can see here is, again, this OPA does not seem to have to come to the surface to warm, and that makes complete sense, right? It has a warm heart, has the whole body is warm, there's no reason for it to come to the surface to warm up. Okay, so this more whole body form of endothermy is significant in that it appears to allow OPA to maintain, enhance physiological function while it's at depth. Okay, so while it's at depth, its muscles are warmer, it can swim faster, its visceral organs are warmer, it can digest things faster, its eye and brain are warmer, it can has higher visual resolution, it can respond faster to stimuli. And so you have this warm-bodied animal down in this deep, cold environment, and he's just feeding on lots of things that are very cold and can't move very fast. And so it's a really, really kind of neat adaptation. And so we can go back to kind of our continuum here of ectotherms and endotherms. We have the regional endotherms in the middle, and the OPA is kind of up here somewhere. It's not on the same level as mammals and birds. Mammals and birds are much warmer than the OPA is. They're able to maintain their temperatures a lot more constant, but it's definitely closer to this endothermy range than, for example, these regional endotherms. Okay, so with that, it's always good to know kind of where we're going with this research. And let's see here. There we go. So what's next? What we'd like to do is kind of get some longer term monitoring of OPA movements and depth distribution, really to figure out what these animals are doing, just to confirm that they're down at depth all the time. And what we'd also like to do is outfit these animals with longer term temperature tags. So get away from this OPA on a ROPA and allow an animal to swim wherever it wants and do whatever it wants, but we're still logging that temperature, right? And so this is what really excites me about research and science, is that you have to come up with new ideas of how to do things. Nobody has ever really tried to log the internal temperature of an animal long-term, or of a fish, I should say, long-term, because fish are usually the same temperature as the water. There's no reason to do that. And so what you have to do is come up with kind of creative ways, especially if you don't have tons of money and you don't have, you can't pay a bunch of engineers to invent a new tag for you. And so what we've done is we've glued a lot of tags together. So this is what's called a pop-up satellite tag. These are pretty common in the marketplace for looking at fish movements. Here is another tag that's covered in some heat wrap here, and here's a thermistor that'll go into the muscle of the fish. We have a couple anchors. This is a timed depth release, so we can program this to release, say, 2 days after we release the animal. And this is all held together by a knitting needle, neutrally buoyant. It took me most of a Saturday to find this exact piece of equipment that we needed for this. And so we can put them all together. And what happens is we can program this time depth release for, say, 24 to 48 hours, something like that. You don't want to do too long, because then the fish is going to swim very, very far away. These OPA are swimming 25 miles a day. And they always swim west. So if you release a fish 10 miles offshore, and this is a true story, we released one 10 miles offshore. 2 days later, it was on the other side of Catalina Island, and it was a 150-mile boat ride round trip to go pick up this tag, which popped off. And so this tag will pop off, pop to the surface, it transmits its location to satellite, and then you get to spend all day looking at the ocean and trying to find this little thing sticking out of the ocean. But we've done that, and we've gotten these really cool temperature profiles for these fish over time. Okay, what else do we want to do? Well, we want to look at the effects of temperature on the heart, blood, muscles, and other organs, and really kind of show that this does increase muscle and other organ performance. And I'd like to just kind of end by, I started by reading a little quote, and I want to end by reading a little quote. This is a very, very funny story that came out. It's titled, "Scientists Have Found a Warm-Blooded Fish and We're Probably All Dead." And so just bear with me, I'm going to read you this. "They're evolving. Though it's been a while, I have written extensively on this site about the dangers of the ocean. It's too big, it's too unexplored, and there are far too many creatures in it we don't understand. And now what little we did understand about fish is being flipped on its head. One of the fundamental truths we knew about these slippery, dead-eyed gill-havers, that they're cold-blooded, turns out might not be the case at all. Scientists have found a warm-blooded fish called the opa, and we can count, or we can start the clock to our extinction. Don't be confused by the opa's name, which is trickily close to something you'd scream at a Greek wedding. And don't be confused by its appearance, which looks like a big, sweet tuna. This is a sign, this is a message from the deep. Fish are changing, they're getting smarter. It won't be long before the warm blood of this fish starts burning hot, hot with the desire to eat us one by one. So obviously that's not gonna happen, but if it did, our next step is to stop the apocalypse. Thanks, I'd like to end there and happy to take any questions.